It's Easter. That may mean many things. You may play the Matthew Passion. One thing is certain, a rabbit will bring you chocolate. You might consume a bun, or perhaps the tears of your people. This week on Lost and Found Ritual, I'm Jonathan Green. In particular, we're looking at the food rituals of Easter, of Passover, and of Orthodox Easter. So, grab a bun, have a listen. Carol Cusack joins us. Carol is Professor of Religious Studies, the University of Sydney. Carol, welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Where does all of this begin?
That's an extraordinarily difficult question. Obviously, Jewish traditions of Passover are very, very much older than the origins of Christianity. And also, many of the more unusual traditions that you mentioned, like bunnies and eggs, they don't belong, of course, to Jewish or to Christian tradition, but they belong to forms of pagan religion that existed before the rise of Christian Europe. Because Christianity's major festivals, I'm sure everyone's aware of that, were overlaid on older traditions.
So we have that older pagan tradition around the changing of seasons. What are we celebrating there?
Well, the spring equinox is tremendously important. Of course, one of the things you must notice is that we are in the Southern Hemisphere, so ours is the autumn equinox, and we're actually getting everything wrong way around. But in the Northern Hemisphere, the spring equinox signals, you know, the confirmation of the return of warmth, fecundity, vegetation, lambs and ducklings and little goats. You know, it's a great time of affirmation after a long and very harsh winter.
Rabbits may, of course, feature in that as well. Did Christ's crucifixion actually fall on Easter or the spring equinox? Or is it like the Queen's birthday, a bit arbitrary?
It's definitely arbitrary. Just like the date of Christmas, which is a little bit different, of course, because it's a stable date and it doesn't change every year, the Christian festival was actually overlaid on older festivals. So Christmas is the birthday of Mithras, the Persian god, and also the Saturnalia and the Yule festival in northern Germanic and Scandinavian parts of Europe. Easter is the resurrection of Jesus, and of course that makes complete and absolute sense. It's the ultimate conquest over death, the forces of darkness, and so it allies naturally with a festival of renewal.
It's here we get this very idea of the movable feast.
Well, in the sense of how the date is calculated, maybe.
Speaking of feasts. Annie Smithers is chef and owner of Le Fermier in Trentham. Annie, welcome. An Easter menu for the cultural Christian, perhaps.
The cultural Christian. Well, it has to be a different menu on Friday than it does on Sunday, because there's all those, what are they, taboos? I don't know if they're taboos. But we need to provide fish on Good Friday.
Yep.
Fish following Lent. And my favourite fish for Easter or Good Friday is smoked cod, which brings a sort of shudder of horror to many.
There were varying reactions to that suggestion, I think.
Yes. Well, I had a very hideous reaction to it as a child and never ate it for years. Yeah. But over the years, I've become very partial to making my customers eat. Very delicious cod, smoked cod, potato, garlic and parsley soup. And it has become one of my favourite times of the whole year to actually make and eat this soup. Mm. And it's delicious. And it converts nearly everybody who doesn't like cod.
Well, there you go. That's a good start. And this is the interesting thing about there is a strong food tradition around Passover.
Yes.
Around Easter, in the non-Orthodox Church, not so much, and yet we have that that beginning there with the fish on Friday, and of course the hot cross bun.
Yes, and the hot cross buns. We like to eat them all the time, and there's.
But we must not.
We shouldn't. We should only eat them on Good Friday.
And to the supermarkets who had them out on Boxing Day, shame on you.
Absolutely.
So we have our hot cross bun, and we've had our fish. Saturday, probably just go to the footy and have
a hot
dog.
Saturday we go to the footy and have a pie.
Yes.
Because it's footy day. And then Sunday tends to be the big, I think the big family celebration day.
Mm.
And, for most Australian families, it really does start with chocolate bunnies and chocolate eggs.
Which is a complex bit of symbolism.
Well, it's a funny thing. It's sort of eggs are, so much of Easter seems to come from pagan. So the whole pagan celebration, which is linked to the spring equinox, which of course we miss because it's the autumn equinox for us.
Mm.
But that era of, that whole fertility, abundance of eggs, birth, reproduction and things, which is really where the eggs come from.
Rabbits and eggs. Say no more.
And there's a wacky German goddess from the pagan times whose name I think is pronounced Eosta, and her representation is that of a rabbit. So that seems to be the theme that's been run with for many years, and particularly since Cadbury developed the art of making moulds that they could have hollow chocolate eggs made out of. And then, but that's a bit of post-industrial cynicism,
yes.
I think.
But then having gorged ourselves, then we light upon, and this again is the spring thing, I'm guessing, is then the fondness for lamb.
Well, the fondness of lamb, the lamb of God.
Which we will now eat, which is somewhat paradoxical.
Well, I suppose he did sacrifice himself for all of us. So, it's the sacrificial lamb. So what do you do with it once you sacrifice it? You've got to eat it.
What will you be doing with it?
What will I be doing with it? I have a run of different lamb things over Easter. This year I have procured whole lambs from a local farmer, and I'm actually spit roasting them.
Okay.
And there's going to be a great abundance of spit roasted lamb, and I'm serving it with a lovely white bean salad that's tossed with pesto. And the last of my autumn.
The last of your basil.
Well, no, that's the last of the basil, but also and a beautiful tomato salad on the side.
The last again.
The last again.
That's the essence of this moment, isn't it? I mean, it's a feast, and I think you capture that with the lamb on the spit.
Yes.
But of those things, of the seasonality of it is so strong.
It is, and it's the celebration. And I think that, in this day and age, in a much more secular world, Easter Sunday is still one of those pivotal family gathering, family feasting, and really getting together and celebrating food and traditions, not necessarily religious, but, that family notion of, getting together on special days and trying to have a lovely time.
Having a bit of a feast.
Having a bit of a feast.
Annie, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure.
Annie Smithers. Carol Cusack is Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Sydney. And Carol, let us step briefly out of Easter towards Passover. And this, as you've told us already, is an earlier ritual and one of great complexity.
Yes, indeed. It's the pivotal story, really, in the book of Exodus, and it celebrates the deliverance of God's chosen people, the Israelites, from their bondage in Egypt. And it gains its name, the idea of passing over, from the protection that the Israelites placed on their doorposts, which was the blood of the sacrificed lamb that they ate for dinner. And what happened was that the angel of death came as the final of the 10 plagues and brought death to the firstborn of all households that didn't have this protective blood on their doorposts. And in the wake of that total disaster, the Israelites departed from Egypt and they crossed the Red Sea, which parted for them, a miraculous protection on the part of God, and the vengeful armies of the Pharaoh who followed them were drowned in the sea as the waters rushed back in, as soon as the chosen people had escaped.
An extraordinary setting there for a very complex series of dishes.
Wollten wir nur von Mitzrayim glücklich aus geleist geworden, nur der Jam sich nicht gespalten, da jeno.
Now, Lisa Goldberg and Marilyn Chalmers are from the Monday Morning Cooking Club, and theirs is a busy time right now. Passover cooking has them flat out. Welcome, Lisa and Marilyn.
Thank you. Hi.
This is such a strong, such a distinct culinary tradition or set of traditions and ideas for Passover, and it's a bit of a sequence. Where do we begin?
Passover has two very, very big dinners on the first two nights, and the whole family and friends gather around a table, and there is quite a set sequence of what we eat and what is traditional for us to eat, depending on what country we come from, but there is still this universality about it.
Well, I've just sat down. What's first?
Well, the very first thing we do actually is dip some parsley in salt water. In the middle of everyone's table, there's a plate with all these different ritual foods that symbolise different things. But the first thing we do is dip parsley in salt water.
Symbolising what?
Well, it's remembering the tears that we shed when we weren't free back in the days in Egypt. So this is a festival that celebrates freedom. And so on this plate, we have firstly the matzah, which is the unleavened bread, which we can talk about for days, actually, which represents that when the Jews fled Egypt, there was no time for their bread to rise. So they eat this. We eat this flat bread, which is actually quite delicious for a few days. By day 4 and 5, you're really sick of it. Then we have a shank bone, which represents the Passover lamb. We have an egg, which is the continuity of life, which actually appears in many of our festivals and throughout the year. Mm. Bitter herbs, we use horseradish, which again to represent the backbreaking work and the bitter times. And my favourite that we could actually talk about is haroset. Got to get that right. Haroset. Marilyn and I were just debating. We each make our own version. And I think most households have their own, depending whether you're a Sephardi or an Ashkenazi Jew, but even the two of us who are both Ashkenazi Jews, we make different ones.
So what are the variations?
So mine is a very traditional one that I absolutely love eating, and it's grated apple, walnuts, cinnamon, and sweet wine. And you mix all that together and you just put it on top of matzah, and it's really delicious.
Okay. Mine is dates. I always say that I was Sephardi in my first life. So right. Mine is dates and apple and walnuts and maybe a little bit of wine, and I zhum it in a zhuma. That's a highly technical term for a food processor.
That's Yiddish for food processor.
Yeah, something like that. And it becomes like a schmear. It's almost like a jam. Texture that you then spread on your matzah and eat.
And this haroset represents the mortar that they used to build the pyramids back in the day. So everything you eat at this meal is representative of something. And then once you've done with the representative food, then you go on to the seriously delicious food. And I think the challenge for all of us in this festival is that because we don't eat leavened bread and we don't eat leavened anything, that means you've got to cut out, you know, yeast, anything with yeast, and then there's an extension, you don't need anything made with flour, apart from the matzah, of course. And so everyone is in this frenzy leading up to this festival, trying to find the best cakes, the best biscuits, the best anything that are baked not using flour. So there's a run on potato flour at the moment, and, you know, everyone's trying these things to make things that taste delicious.
You're allowed to use things like lentil flour or chickpea flour? Are they acceptable?
That really depends on what culture you're from. In the Ashkenazi world, no. In the Sephardi world, yes. So it's a little bit confusing.
Okay.
But the universal thing that certainly in Australia you will find in almost every home is chicken soup and matzo balls.
I was going to say, we are moving inevitably towards chicken soup.
Yes. I've got some on the stove right now.
How long will that cook?
Possibly it could be done in a couple of hours, but to be honest, mine's been on for about 6 hours now, and I just let it bubble away at a very, very low heat.
And the making of the matzo balls, is that a family thing? Is that a time to sort of gather around and join in?
It is. I mean, I love it when my mum, myself and my daughter, we get together and we make the matzah balls every year. And it's a very special time. And it's also quite funny for different families because there are sinkers and there are floaters. And some people have beautiful light matzah balls that, that almost float in the soup and you put your spoon in and it's lovely and luscious. And then you have those that are, have sunk to the bottom of the bowl and they're like little golf balls. And you know what? Everyone loves their own matzah balls, whether they're, you know, whichever one of those they are. But they are so traditional and they are such an essential part of Passover for us.
It is wonderful to have such a defined and such a resonant set of foods. And the symbolism being so rich is a tremendous thing.
Yeah, it warms my heart when I think that there are families all over the world at the exact same point in time sharing the same feeling, the same story and the same kind of foods.
And eating just this. Yes. Lisa, Marilyn, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thanks a lot.
Carol Cusack is Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Sydney. And Carol, the Orthodox Church, its celebration of Easter not in sync with the Western Church.
No, that's true. In 325, the Council of Nicaea determined that Easter would be the Sunday after the first full moon after the spring equinox. They always calculate spring equinox as 21 March, and that means in the West, Easter's celebrated anywhere between 22 March and 25 April. The difference with the Eastern Church is that the Eastern Church still uses the Julian calendar, named for Julius Caesar, whereas in Western Europe, that was abandoned in 1582, and Pope Gregory the 13th introduced what's called the Gregorian calendar, which is more accurate.
And of course, there will be food. Kathy Supless is author of her book Sweet Greek and Sweet Greek Life. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you.
Greek Orthodox Easter is coming, and here's another time with very, very specific ideas around food.
Absolutely. It's probably the most important event in the Greek or in the Orthodox calendar, not just Greek, it's, I should say, Orthodox calendar. It really is. We have a period where we're fasting for 40 days. It's a period of Lent. Mm-hmm. And then we feast on the Easter Sunday.
How strict is that fasting?
Well, look, once upon a time it used to be quite strict, but nowadays it isn't really. It depends. Like if you take in my family, we have been fasting, and what you fast from is meat and dairy products.
Yep.
So we choose to fast the whole 40 days. From a health perspective as well, it's actually quite good for you. You end up eating
lots. Detox.
Yes, it is. It's actually quite a lovely detox. And kind of on a side note, it's a little bit like this intermittent fasting concept that's waves at the moment.
Yep.
But most people don't, you know, they'll fast the last week, which is easy to do. So they won't do the whole 40 days.
So having fasted, especially from meat, I'm seeing a lamb in your future.
Correct. Easter Sunday. Yes. Easter Sunday. It's all about feasting, sitting around a table, family, friends, lamb on the spit. In Greece, you'd probably have a goat on the spit. Salads and bread, and of course tzoureki and red eggs that we all have to crack and celebrate.
How do we make the red eggs?
The red eggs are very easy. You have to have a particular dye that we use, and there's all this sort of there are lots of theories about how to make the best dyed eggs, but I think it's very simple to me. You just make sure that you have good eggs, soak them overnight, ensure that you remove the cracked ones because you can get sort of hairline cracks in some of the eggs and you don't want that. They'll have bubbles so you can tell that there's a crack in the egg. So you remove them and then you start the process. You mix the dye, which comes in a sachet, with a little bit of water, and then you pour it into your pot. You need to use vinegar as well, and then you just very slowly boil them, the eggs, maybe 10 minutes or so, because I know it's a little bit longer than a hard-boiled egg, but we want the dye to attach to the egg. And then when they come out, you have to then wipe them with a soft cloth and olive oil or any oil to give them that lovely shine. You can use stickers, perhaps. You can do all that sort of stuff, but very easy.
So amongst all these things, is there a favourite for you?
For me, the entire Holy Week is a beautiful, beautiful week. It's you start off on the Monday, you start the baking process. Like, for example, I might make the kuluria, which are lovely plated biscuits. They're a traditional Easter biscuit. We then, this Monday for me, because I don't have any other time, but I have to make them on Monday, the Tsurekia. There's church every night of the Holy Week that you can go to. Not everybody goes every night, but you can every night. Thursday is the traditional day where we dye our eggs. And Thursday is also the day where traditionally you make tsurekia.
Tell me a bit more about the tsurekia.
Now, tsurekia is a yeasted bread. And listening to Lisa earlier speaking, they avoid having any yeast and things where we use this yeasted bread. It's a yeasted bread. It goes back to ancient times. It's meant to represent the rebirthing, because we're using flour in that bread. It represents the resurrection and new birth and rebirth. And the plaits are meant to ward away evil spirits, though, because they're all plaited innately, you know, beautifully done. So that's the theory. That's where it comes from.
Where does that sit in that meal then with...
Well, on Easter Sunday, so the what you do is you have your table set with all the beautiful things that you put on that table. In the centre, you have your tsureki bread, and you'll also have another platter with all your red eggs. So you start the meal by everybody getting a red egg, and the winner is the person who doesn't have any break on his egg. So we all play these games where we've dyed wooden eggs. My dad actually once made a wooden egg, a wooden egg and dyed it red so that my boys could have something to play with and end up being the winners. So there's lots of fun like that. It's such good fun. The eggs that we break, we then clean them, cut them up, put them on a platter, and you eat them. At the end of the meal, we'll have the tsureki, because it's sweet, and we'll have it with, you know, tea and coffee or, you know, whatever, or dessert wine, whatever you choose.
And the fast is truly broken.
The fast is truly broken, yes. And then we have to roll ourselves out of the house or the kitchen.
Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carol Cusack, we've heard some wonderful food traditions. It has led us, though, inevitably to perhaps the last of them, and perhaps the most difficult to explain in terms of religion, and that is chocolate.
Ah, well, chocolate is not entirely difficult to explain, partly because the great families that became chocolate manufacturers in England, for example, in the 19th century, like the Fries and the Cadburys, they were devout Christians. I think actually both families were Quakers. And the promotion of chocolate, both as a hot drink and as a sweet treat, was something that was not sinful and wicked, you know, like alcohol, or in some nonconformist traditions, even coffee and tea were considered stimulants and so not virtuous. So making chocolate was actually, a faithful Christian way to give people something to celebrate without sin.
An indulgence at the end of an austere Lenten period, chocolate. Yes, as you say, that sounds perfect. You've been listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production, this week on ritual. You heard from Annie Smithers, chef and owner of De Fermier in Trentham, Victoria, Lisa Goldberg and Marilyn Chalmers from the Monday Morning Cooking Club, Kathy Supplis, author of Sweet Greek, and Carol Cusack, professor of religious studies, the University of Sydney. Producers are Mira Adler-Gillies and Buffy Gorilla. Technical production by Melissa May. I'm Jonathan Green.